that's not the case. The spammers on the web, on blogs, on email, want you to read things you don't want to see. And so they're trying to figure out how it is you're controlling what you're seeing and defeat it. And we've talked about that a little bit in the abstract. But picking spam filtering as an example is one we've all read with. We've all seen things. We've all looked at our spam and wondered, why is somebody sending me this? I mean, so I looked at it. That, what kind of good did it do them, right? Why did they write in this funny way or whatever? And so it's a really nice way of bringing the issues back together around adversarial retrieval, one of the fundamental issues. And it's a nice target for the issues that had previously been scattered around the platform. Just talk about the basic ideas, the broad ideas of information filtering, and then focus down on a set of technical issues, the last one, which is that's where we're going. Okay. So here's a sort of sketch that you wouldn't really want to do it this way, but just a sketch of the definition of filtering. Now, what we're used to, what we've been talking about so far, is the information need is different every time. We haven't been really thinking so much about cases where people come and they want to know something, and the next time they come back, they want to know something related to the previous query. So we keep taking the query words and matching them, but we don't take the previous query and do anything with that. So we make the untrue assumption that every time our user shows up, they want something different. And we just ignore any relationships that exist. And we also make the untrue assumption that our collection never changes. So we can index the collection, which is a phenomenally large investment of time and energy, and then the different queries will be posted against the same collection. Right? You see how that's essentially what we've been talking about so far. Okay. So information filtering makes exactly the opposite assumption. We assume that what we want to know is the same all the time. It never changes. So I'm interested in reading good, recent articles in information retrieval, because that's my professional area. And as soon as a good, recent article becomes available, I want to be told about that. So my information need is constant. And we assume that every time we do a search, the collection is different. So the standard way of thinking about this is that there is there's a pipe, it's got documents flowing through it, like water, and what I want to do is I want to pick out of that some of the documents that I want to see. Okay. Now, it's not immediately apparent from this, but the fact that these are in the opposite corners means that they share a common characteristic, and to see why, just imagine that we flip the axis. Right. So we can think of, this is the case where the query is in search of a document, and we can think of this as the case where the document is in search of a person. Right. And so we can do things like index people, which would seem like a strange thing to do normally. Not if you're an expertise, I guess, but. So you can do that, and that leads you off in interesting directions. Now, if you think about it, the real problem is that people are asking different things about different documents. The web is changing, right? There's a high link rot rate on the web as things break. And people do, in fact, develop different information needs. But it's not the case that everything people want to know is different every time. And it's not the case that the collection is different every time. The collection is similar to last time, and the things you want to know are related to the things you wanted to know last time, right? You probably, for example, don't start issuing queries in Swahili if you've never done that before. Right? So what's really going on is that you're operating someplace out here and someplace out there. And if you're operating closer to this, it's useful to think of your problem as retrieval. If you're operating closer to this, it's useful to think of your problem as filtering. and then start fixing things that, you know, are not quite true. So for example, in retrieval, we often have the problem, how do I do incremental indexing? So now more documents arrive, how do I update my index? But that presumes you had an index, and it wouldn't have made any sense at all to index in this situation when you're doing filtering, because the collection is different every time. So you'd index it and then throw it away. Index it and then throw it away. Wouldn't make any sense at all. Okay? Alright. So, there's a little bit of vocabulary. In information retrieval, we call the query a profile. That sort of suggests that what I'm doing is I'm describing you rather than in your information needs, rather than your particular query at the time. It's not any different from a query in that it is the expression to the machine of the information needs, but when it's stable, we just use this term profile. The second thing is that it is a normal assumption when people are talking about this, that I have to make a decision on every document. Now, if you think about that, that doesn't admit ranking, right? So I've got these things flowing by, and I either have to take it or not. After a week, I have a set of things I've taken. So this fits very well with things like Boolean queries. But in ranked retrieval, there's not really a sense in which one thing's better than another. So I either show it to you or I don't. Right? So the sort of standard setup of the problem is that I'm going to do that. I'm going to do a set-based approach. I'm going to do it incrementally, one document at a time. That's going to have to create a whole host of problems for me. This tendency to think that this stuff is new. So in fact, a fellow named Denning, who was the president of the Association for Computing Machinery, who invented the term filtering in 1975, believing that he was making a contribution to computer science. In library science, people had been working on selective dissemination of information for quite some time before that. Did I tell you the story of how we stopped calling it SDI?
Star Wars.
Because of Star Wars, right? You couldn't search for it, SDI anymore without finding documents or whatever, right? So it turned out to be convenient to change the name without the right time. Okay. So, this is sort of the basic idea. You've got a whole set of documents. You've got some profile. The machine makes some recommendation to the user. And in many of these setups, the user comes back and tells the machine, I liked it, I hated it, whatever. Okay. So it seems like it should be a great opportunity to use the stuff we know about relevant feedback. Here's the actual way that in real organizations, filtering is done today. You get an information retrieval system. It's got a whole bunch of stuff in it, a whole bunch of documents in there. It can be any kind of a retrieval system you like. You then build this incredibly complex honking query, right? Big Boolean queries for whatever it is you need to see on a regular basis. You need to be trained in how to do this, and you need to have a collection that you can run the Boolean query against to kind of see if in this collection this Boolean query does roughly what we want. Okay, and then every time this is a profile, there's nothing to it. Then every time a document comes by, we just check it against the query, see if it fits, and if it does, we give it to you. If we had an information retrieval system, we could simply rerun the query, like the one in the library. You could just rerun the query and say, you know, any good papers in the last day? Any good papers in the last day? Just stick a date restriction on it. That'd be horribly wasteful because we spend a lot of time indexing it and we only ask about the things in the last day. Right? But that would work. And in a real system, what you do is you just take this and give it a way of seeing each document as it comes by, you don't worry about it after that. Okay? So here's an example of a system that does that. You got to sort of suspend disbelief here for a few minutes to get your head around. Here's what these people do. They go out and they build a computer that looks for the word good. A really good computer on a chip. But all it does, the only thing this computer does in its entire life, is it looks for the word good. Then they build another computer that looks for the word great, and another one that looks for party, and another one that looks for eight. And they do this for thousands of words. And so what they've got is they've got a set of word detectors, except the word detectors don't check the characters individually to see if they're what they're looking for, and then check the next word, and then check the next word. What you do is you take the document and you flow it through this. Right? So this checks the first word, and then while this is checking the first word, this checks the second word. And while this is checking the second word, this is checking the third word. So the document's going from, the words in the document are moving between these detectors. Do you see what I'm talking about? Okay. Then we build another computer that checks to see if I've got this word or that word, and when it does, it lights a light. Right? So if this lights the light and says, I got this word, and this one doesn't, this one just lights the light and says, we got one of those words. So I got a computer that does nothing except take two inputs and put out an output. And the same thing over there for not, and the same thing down here for and. And when the light lights, we got one. And boom, we drop it into your inbox, and you can look at it. Now, what's the beauty of this? Well, for all of the processing you're doing, you're doing things like saying, is the first word this? Is the second word this? Is the third word this? Okay, it is. So I'm going to, once I found this word, then let's go see what the second word is, the third word is, the fourth word is, and after a while, I found a bunch of words and I can compute this Boolean expression. Here what we've done is we've gone out and we built a computer that isn't a general purpose programmable computer. It's a computer that can only take a stream of documents through it and light the light at the right time. Now you can put delay lines on these things so that anywhere in these five words it would still light the light, you know, through the beginning of the document and the end of it. And so if you wanted to, for example, build a dirty word detector, you know, is anybody using dirty words in their email in your company, you could run all the email in the company through this thing. You could have all the dirty words that you could think of with little pieces of your system programmed for it. And no matter how much email people generated, you could keep up with it. Right? So this is a kind of parallel processing where we're streaming the data through a whole set of processors, all of which are computing at the same time. Make sense?
When you were first describing it, it sounded very old school, and when we mentioned email, is this what we call snippers now? You're watching data streams?
Oh, well, these days, people don't do this much because the computers have gotten so fast that I can take a general purpose programmable computer, which is very cheap, it's built as a commodity, and I can program it, and then I can just get 100 computers, actual real computers, that are fully programmed.
Yeah.
Okay. So the only people that do this now are people who are interested in phenomenal data volumes.
Yeah, like
can't you know anybody who's interested in a phenomenal data volume? Right. But the only thing you can do with this is find in limited regions of documents dirty words.
Yeah. It's like an extensive way to program.
What's that?
It's like an extensive way to program.
It is. On the other hand, if you had a bunch of very simple questions and you needed very high throughput, it's faster than any other way you could get it through. So if you could, for example, get an entire computer company to build these things for you, you'd need it. So this was, for example, the way a lot of the early work on genetics was done. Right? You could do, you know, you want to do gene sequence matching, you got this sequence, you want to know if it matches anything in that sequence. So I just load in the sequence in here, and then I run the whole other sequence by it. Right. So, so the people that made these had a limited number of customers, and one of them were the people doing genetics.
Is that, like, the IBM supercomputers, or like BlueGene, is that related at all? I don't know what Blue Jean did, but this is, it would be reasonable to adopt this one. Okay? So this is from 1996. Right? And at the time, it was able to do 10,000 documents per second. Not 10,000 words per second, 10,000 documents per second. And of course, computers are much faster. Okay. Now, if we think about this general approach that I'm going to build a profile, and then I'm going to run a bunch of stuff by and check it against the profile. That's the basic approach that we did in hardware, but we can do that in software. We're just going to run the documents by and check them. One of the big problems with that is that every profile is treated separately. So you've got to have your machine, I've got to have my machine, you've got to have your machine. So if I've got a large organization, I've got people responsible for different things. I don't want to think about this as the question, does Doug need to see it? I want to think about this as the question, who needs to see it? So what I want to do is I want to have a document come in, and instead of deciding whether or not to show it, this is the first setup, I want to decide who to show it to. So if you just think in a Boolean search approach for a little while, here's what I do. Let's say that I have everybody in my organization make up profiles. Maybe each one of you gets to make up 100 profiles. So I don't know, you're interested in travel to Europe, and you're also interested in currency exchange rates, and you're interested in you know, short-haired huskies, and I don't know, whatever it is you're interested in, right? You create separate profiles for all these things that you care about, and you register them with my service, my central service for your company or your group. And then what I'll do is, instead of having a index that is termed by documents, I'll have an index that's termed by people. So here are the terms that you asked for, and here are the terms that somebody else asked for, and so I'll get these vectors of terms, and each vector of terms are the terms in the queries. Then when a document comes in, the document has terms in it, I'll take those terms and I'll match them into this, and I'll find out which people want to see documents with that term in it, which people want to see documents with this other term in it, and only for those people will I check the Boolean relationships to see if, in fact, they actually want to see it. In the same way that we did before, in showing documents to people, now we're going to essentially show people the documents. So, well, you document, you've arrived, and ask the question which person in your organization needs to see it. Right? Okay, so that's what you do. It turns out not to be too hard to do this. In main memory, you can hold the profiles for a healthy portion of the United States in 1 gigabyte of RAM. So, you know, if everybody had one profile. So there's no reason you can't do this on several machines in parallel. So this is simply turning things upside down. You could do this for a vector space matching as well, but then you'd have to figure out how to tune the thresholds. This should make you very nervous. I mean, just think what you just did. You took what you're interested in, and you sent it to me. And I will use this to blackmail you, I'll publish it on the front page of the New York Times. Right? So you better trust this organization. You might actually like it better back in the days where everybody ran their own filter. But now you can run your own filter. So if you want to do spam filtering on email, okay, maybe everybody has the same definition of spam, and this is really easy, and you want to do it centralized. But if you want to do it for things that match your interests, you might not want to, one company might not want to subscribe to a service run by another company. How would IBM like to register all of their interests and send them off to, who's IBM competing with anymore, anyway? Apple. What's that?
Yeah, what do they do anymore anyway? Okay, so that's one problem. A second problem is, if I have an intelligence analyst or something, okay, fine. They'll sit there and they'll tweak the profile, and if it doesn't work well enough, they'll tweak the profile again. If there's an explosion someplace, they'll tweak the profile again. Because I'm paying them to do that, right? But I mean, this is never going to work for ordinary people. They're not going to sit around and say, ooh, well, I didn't get a movie nut clause in the right spot here, so, you know, I got my parentheses screwed up here, let's do it again. So, it's very time consuming to build, and then, of course, the world will change and make it out of it. The biggest problem here is, if I do some kind of threshold on a topic, that threshold that I should set depends upon which topic it is. Right? Think about how TF and IDF work. Let's say that I have a topic that has a bunch of very common terms in it. So everything has a low IDF, right? Well, that means that the highest score a document can get is pretty low. Now I have some other topic that's only got one term in it, but that term's hardly ever used. That'll have a really high IDF. Right? And that really high IDF will mean that I have to set a high threshold if I want to avoid false alarms. So I've got this this problem that the threshold values aren't normalized across topics. I can't set a threshold for me. I have to set a threshold for what I'm interested in. So if I'm interested in 20 things, I got to choose 20 thresholds.
Or did you just say that they're inverse? The IDF is inversely related to the threshold?
Yeah, but if I have a multi-term query in a ranked retrieval, and I'm trying to build a threshold on that, then I've got a lot of terms that can have different IDFs.
We just limit it to one term?
Yeah, you can limit it to one term, and then you know, you might not have any customers, but you certainly have a very easy interaction set. Okay. Okay, so this is a block diagram of roughly what I just described. And it uses the approach you know of Grocchio relevant feedback. So here's a picture. Starts in here. The user puts in some profile terms. So this is just whatever terms the user would like to search for. Just think of it as flat. So make a vector, and we'll call that vector the user model. So this is the query, essentially. Right? This is just the first query. Then a document arrives. We compute the similarity with the user model. So you can think of normalized inner product here, or BM25, or whatever you want. We take the documents, the vectors, and what we know about the rank order. The user looks through them and assign some ratings. They say which ones they like, which ones they don't like. They don't say anything about them. You then use Grocchio's relevance feedback formula I showed you time before last. Anybody remember Grocchio's relevance feedback formula? What is it? What's that?
I remember.
Do you remember there being a Grocchio formula? I see. Okay. So I actually took out that slide and I filled it in. Here's the formula. So if I've got the profile, which is a vector, at time x plus 1, it's equal to the profile, which is a vector, at time x plus alpha times the mean of the relevance plus beta times the mean of the non-relevance. Or beta is negative, so we'll just write it as minus beta. So what this says is, if I have a vector space model, I've got a point, and that point is the query. Right? Remember, so the way the vector space model works, I'm going to go pick up a point on the net on the floor, and everything's going to be some distance from it as the net unfolds below me, right? Yes? Good on that? Okay. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that point on the floor that I picked up, and I'm going to move it towards the relevant documents. Not all the way over the relevant documents, just some distance in favor of the relevant documents. And so if there are 20 relevant documents, I'll just take the averages of 20 relevant documents. And then I'm going to, let's say I have some non-relevant documents, I'm going to move it away from the non-relevant documents. Okay, so there was an example of that in earlier slides. Okay, so that gets me an updated model. The updated model will allow me to see extra documents as they come in. Some of them will get sent to me to look at. I will assign ratings and update the model further. All right, so it's sort of a hill climbing approach. I find a useful profile. It attracts some documents. Those documents I use to improve the spot. So I find the higher spot on the hill. And it's like I'm constantly looking for the peak, the perfect query. I'm always trying to move in a direction that's towards a better spot, a spot with a better peak. Yes? So people call this approach hill climbing. Make sense? Okay. Now, there's no threshold to be tuned here, right? I didn't put in a spot where it says, now tune the threshold. So how did I get away without tuning the threshold?
You let the user rate them.
Let the user rate what?
The relevance of the documents they got the system showed to them.
So I, there's something about the answer I don't understand. So let me go back across. I have documents flowing by, and I have to decide whether to show you a document or not. That's what the threshold is used for, right? So I have some way of telling whether this is a good document, some way of assigning it a score. I'm going to show you whether it's a good document or not. And I'm not doing that here. Right? There's no way of deciding whether it's a good document or not. So I've got an implicit assumption here. Can you see what it is?
Oh, it's like somewhere around here.
Where it says rank order. So how can I be rank ordering things? I mean, if I've got a threshold, it's telling me to show it to you or not. That's not what I'm doing here. So here's what I'm doing. I'm batching these things up overnight, finding out everything that came in overnight, and then I'll just rank order everything that came in overnight. So this does no longer works real time. Now you have to be willing to wait long enough for me to get a set of things to rank. And if you're willing to do that, I can skip the threshold business.
Now it's just an alert.
Now it's just
an alert.
It was an alert before.
Okay.
It was lighting a light saying you'll like this document.
It's a batch IR process.
Mm-hmm. Now it's a repeating batch IR process. Not really batch, it's repeating, there's a user in the loop.
Oh.
But it's a repeating set of IR processes. It's the same IR process that you knew. Yeah? And this is how you train your spam filter. Right? You don't go, well, maybe you do. Oh my God, another message has arrived. Right? You get up in the morning and you read your email. A whole bunch of stuff has arrived and you go, spam, 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 spam. Retrain. Right? That's what's going on when you retrain the...
I'm being fancy. How is this different? You know, this is different. I can't really figure out why. Why is this different from the Google alert, which I'm not actually too good about, but, you know, where it just, you know, 6 a.m. every morning, it runs this query that I saved against the corpus, traditional IR. It's not...
Well, okay, so then does it see only new documents, or does it see...
Yeah.
So it's got a little time window on?
I don't know how it does it.
Yeah,
actually,
okay, so you're in the same place.
But it's just running a regular query.
It's looking at an index. This would look at flow. It has to build a little collection overnight.
Right.
Yeah.
No functional difference?
Well, your system is not adaptive, right?
Well, I don't know. Can you retrain your system?
Can you tell it what you want to do?
Yeah, So it's doing this.
Why? You get your results, say, I don't like that edit. It. You know, add another not close.
Oh, but you have to edit the query.
Yeah.
You don't edit the query here. You just tell it I like it, I made it, and
it
updates.
Right.
Okay? Okay. So this is relatively straightforward, right? The only thing that I added was we batch things up, and we avoid the threshold by using a rank list. Okay? Okay. Now, this is a picture of my dissertation, I'm sorry. But it was in the original classes, and I thought, oh, it's so cool, I get to actually pull it out. So let me just tell you what it is I worked on and why it was really important and interesting. The rest of you can go to sleep. So if you look at what we did before, you'll see that four boxes have been added. Right, so you see the four new boxes? Probably should have added two. Okay. So here's what we got. In come the document vectors. We make them into better document vectors somehow. This is some technique for taking document vectors in and making, what the author meant to say was, and saying it in a way that's easier to search for. Okay? You can ignore this. This is just a setup to get you to the same space. Then we do all the same things that we were doing, and we measure whether the sets of documents we're giving you here are better each time. All right, so we run the evaluation on this rank list, and I can tell if this trick improved that rank order. Yes? With me? So now all I have to do is tell you how this trick works. Now, this vector has how many dimensions?
Size of
the
lexicon.
Size of lexicon, which is roughly?
100,000.
Yeah, okay, a couple hundred thousand. So this has got a couple of 100,000 terms in it, and one of those terms is happy, and another one of those terms is glad. And if my query has happy in it, it takes quite a while before I learn that I should add glad to it. After I see some documents that have happy and glad in them, I start moving towards glad. Right? So that I can eventually get there, but it takes me a while to figure that out. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take happy and glad, and I'm going to give them the same vector. So if you say happy or if you say glad, I'll just replace your vector for happy, or your position for happy, your position for glad, I'll just make them the same spot in the vector. Right? So I'll have the happy glad spot. Okay. If you have class and course, I'll put them together. I'm going to find a way of detecting synonymy automatically. And when I do this, I'll need fewer dimensions. Because happy and glad used to be two, but now they're one. Class and course used to be two, but now they're one. So I'm just mapping synonyms together. Yes? With me? Okay. In order to do this, I need to have a definition of a term. Right? If I have definitions of terms and I notice the two definitions are the same, I can use the same term to represent both of them, right? Yes? Okay. I mean, conceptually, I'm getting this look like, okay, but I want to see the formula. Okay. Here's the formula. Let's say I have a set of documents. This is actually very, very cool. So here's document one, document two, document 5,726 documents, and I've got term one, term two, down to term M. All right, well, let's make this term two. Okay. So let's say that term 46 here appears in this pattern of documents. Okay? And let's say term 89 here appears in this pattern of documents. You might say, here are two terms that whenever one is used, the other one is used. I don't know, these terms, they seem to get along very well. Whenever one is not used, the other one is not used. Therefore, my definition of a term is the set of documents in which it appears. And so I will make my my term similarity computations based on the vectors across of that describes the term across the documents. You with me? You understand the basic idea? Okay. So this is called
the generalized vector space model. Instead of representing a document as a set of terms, I represent a term as a set of documents, and I do this folding together computation. Okay, how's the folding together done? Well, this case is pretty obvious, right? Okay. What if that was a 1? Then you'd say, well, these aren't the same term, but they're pretty close. Right? So I tell you that what I would like to do is I'd like to create 2 matrices. This is a matrix, right? I'd like to create 2 matrices. One that is terms,
down to term 200,000,
by something, we'll call it K. And another matrix that is K by document, such that when I multiply these 2 matrices together, I get something very close to this matrix. Okay, now, it's a fact from linear algebra, the branch of mathematics that is sort of arithmetic on matrices, that if I make K D, right, or T, whichever one is smaller, I can do this exactly. There's nothing that would prevent me from getting exactly this back, because the rank of a matrix is the minimum of this number and that number, or less. So as long as I'm willing to run K out that far, I can reproduce this matrix exactly. Now, if I make K too small, I start to get some differences. So imagine that I've gotten it down to the minimum that I can get, which is, instead of calling it K, we'll call it R, because it is the rank of matrix. So this is now the smallest value of K that would allow exact reproduction. Okay. If I do that, then I can create another matrix in between, that is R by R, and is diagonal. It has no elements that aren't on the diagonal, such that every element here is normalized, every element here is normalized, and it still comes back to this. So I just captured the scaling factors of the normalization in here. And this decomposition is well known in mathematics. It's called the singular value decomposition. So you just go out and you buy a singular value decomposition package, and you get this, you pump this matrix into it, and out this comes. Many minutes later, but it figures out this matrix, these 3 matrices, such that they can be multiplied together. Okay? Now, you can also sort this so that the largest number is here, the second largest number is here, and so on and so forth. Right? So the largest, the most important, what's called singular vector is here, the second most important one is here, the third most important one is there, and so on and so forth. And then I'll come along and I'll just wipe out these really small ones, which mathematically is done by just setting those values to 0. And what I get is I get an approximation to this matrix that is as close as you can possibly get with only k dimensions for whatever we picked k to be. So now I've got k less than r. And I have got the closest possible reproduction of the original matrix, throwing away the least amount of signal. This is a very common trick. You've seen this done over and over again. If you've ever seen an old photograph and it's been cleaned up a little bit with Photoshop or something, that's what they do. They find the variants and they go throw away the parts that are behaving randomly, and they keep the parts that seem to have a lot of signal in. Right? So this is a common trick in signal processing. So we call these pieces over here representations of the noise in signal processing, and we call these the signal. Yeah.
So the final result is that it places unusual rows with rows, well, unusual patterns with patterns that occur more often.
No, it replaces the difference between happy and glad with zero. So happy and glad actually mean different things. I mean, you know, happy is a dwarf and glad is a kind of Saran wrap, right? So they have similar meanings, but with some distinction, right?
Okay.
So it throws away small distinctions, and he keeps the distinction between happy and pissed off, which don't tend to get used very often
again. You're not going back on original nature. I'm sorry, that was my
We probably should close the door. People want to talk.
There's no row for happy in this.
Well, there is in the original matrix.
But not in the one you're talking
about. But when we're done with this, we only keep this T by R thing.
Okay. Do you have a happy glad row?
Yeah, I have a happy glad row conceptually. Now, it turns out that the matrix is, I mean, it's doing mathematical tricks, so there's actually not a happy glad row,
right.
But there's some combination of rows that represent happy glad.
There's a row in there that used to be the happy.
Not a row anymore. No, because what the matrix is a set of these matrices are vectors that are mutually orthogonal and normalized, so they're called orthonormal. So I've got a set of orthonormal vectors. They are basis, they span a space, and there's a vector in that space that's happy glad. Okay? If I were to rotate it, I could get that to be on the row. But I don't have to.
I'm going to hold on to that Photoshop metaphor. It's hard.
Okay. So what's going on is we're washing out differences at the cost of no longer being able to quite point at it and say what's going on, and also at the cost of losing all these zeros. So now all these numbers are dense. Every one of these values, 200,000 of them, are non-zero. So the ability to build the inverted index and save a lot of space is going well. But I only have to actually keep R as well. So then it depends on what R. And it turns out a good number for R is somewhere between 300 and 8,000. And it's roughly the number of concepts that you find expressed in the collection. So if I have a small collection that spans a small number of concepts, 300 might be good. If I have a large collection, 8,000 might be good. People don't tend to do this anymore on big collections because it's very expensive to do that and keep 8,000 dimensions. But people now often do this on result sets when they come back, if they want to cluster in result sets. Because it's a very small number of dimensions you can do it very fast. Okay, anyway, that's an automatic trick for reducing dimensions. But I have to have a collection that tells me whether happy and glad are used in the same documents, right? Now think about the problem, because this one's going to come back all night, that we have here. My documents are arriving one at a time. But I already have to have my term document matrix built before I can do this. Yes? And so this doesn't fit filtering very well in its normal application. So what I have to do is I have to go get a set of documents from a friend who's already been collecting them. They have to use language in a way that's representative of my application. And I have to do my singular value decomposition on those documents. And that tells me how to do the mapping. And then I can fold more documents into the space. Okay. When you do that, you can then examine this rank order and see if your results get better. Yes.
Can you explain how you do this process on the result?
Okay, so I have a document that comes in, and I have a matrix that has been computed. Right? So for every term in here, I now have some numbers like 0.6, 1.7, 0.9, 2.5. Let's just have a four-dimensional matrix, right? So I've got 200,000 terms by four.
So every one of these four dimensions, which would be 300 to 8,000 dimensions, every one of these four, every one of these rows represents a term. So now let's say you get in a new document, and your new document is happy, grumpy, what are the seven dwarfs?
Sleepy.
Happy, grumpy, sleepy, can we do all seven?
Dopey,
sneezy.
Doc.
And Ben. Okay, we'll probably do that. I'm better with the original seven after all. None of them were named Happy, as you know. Okay, so I would take the, let's say I got in that document. I take the rows for those, and I'd add them all up and divide by the number of terms of the document. That would give me the vector that would represent the document. Yes? And then I just do that. That process is called fold again. Good? Okay. So you can actually go home and implement this. I mean, relatively. I'm not kidding, you can. It's built into MATLAB. Right, you just go to, get the matrix and you do an SVD and you can see all this stuff and multiply these things together. Not for your projects, but you could, if you want.
What is it built into?
MATLAB.
That's a package for manipulating matrices. Alright, so that would allow you to perhaps make better ranked lists faster. Sooner or later, you would have converged the other way by adding all the terms you could think of. Write all the terms in related documents, and the only thing this could do for you is help you to converge faster. Yep.
So how come we waited until we got filtering to do this? Why not do this when you're indexing a collection for a regular search? If it usefully collapses in the
net? That would work equally well. Okay. That's where it was first developed.
Okay.
So I did my dissertation on how to do it for filtering.
And this world just coming to it now. Okay. Is that right? In this class?
Right. Okay. Right. It's a general technique for dimensionality reduction for the pressure tree. Since there's interest in this, you want to know what the problems with it are?
Yes.
Okay. So, because otherwise, you're sort of left with the idea that this is a really good idea that we didn't hear about earlier, right? Okay. So one problem with this is that the matrices get pretty large and the computation gets very expensive. So there are approximations that have been developed for all of that that address that problem. The second problem is that you can no longer index. So now you've got 8,000 by 8,000 vectors that you're multiplying together. So the efficiency actually gets worse. Okay? That'll be okay as long as the effectiveness got better. But there's a little bit of a problem with the effectiveness because let's say that I have a vector space which I'll just draw in two dimensions. So sort of imagine that it's a large dimensional vector space. And I have the concept of happiness. Not the word happy, but the concept of happiness. So every time the concept of happiness is meant, you should be here in the vector space. And up here is the concept of gladness. And you're like, oh, those things should be together, right? Up here is the concept of dwarfness. Okay? Now, if I have a collection in which it's literature, I'll have more dwarfness than if I have a concept that is, I'm not sure that's true. Well, and engineering documents, right? Engineering documents will have little about dwarfs, but maybe something about happiness. So, I'd be all the way over here, in some cases, and happiness, which is what I'm trying to fold together with gladness. And sometimes I'd be sitting out here where I've got both happiness and dwarfness. And the more dwarfness I have, the more I get pulled away from happiness. So what I land up doing is I land up mapping this point, not this point, this point, together with gladness. Right, so I land up, I can't tell the difference between happy being used to express happiness and happy being used to express dwarf. And so, which is homonymy, same word used for two different things. So I land up with a
with a point that is not really representing a word that I'm trying to put together with another word, but rather some funky thing with the vector space. And I fold that together. And when I do, my space is not as well designed as you would have liked to see that from the available lessons. And so then it's an empirical question whether or not you get improvement. If you do this, you get you can plot this. So this is like mean average precision as a measure there, right, of how well my of how good my rank list is. And this is K. Now, K can become no larger than the size of the collection or the number of words in the language, whichever is smaller, which I'll call R, right, the rank of your matrix. And the mean average precision of working out here at R is this amount, which I'll just draw as a reference line across. So at R, this does exactly the same computation that the ordinary vector space does, except you get out a whole lot of mechanical horsepower, and then you get exactly the same number. Not approximately the same number, exactly the same number. Now, below R, there are two possibilities. One is that you get an improvement for some K, and then it converges back down to R. Because it's got to be zero at no dimensions, right? I mean, if you got nothing, you got nothing. And it's got to be whatever the map is at R by the time you get out to R, because you reconstructed your whole matrix. So what, this is what you want, and you want to measure this. And you want to know how to guess that. Right? You want to know how to pick, you want to know how to get that point, you want to know how good it is. The possibility you don't want is it could go like this, right? So you'd be unhappy. It turns out it does go like this if you don't do TF. This is a raw TF, and this is VM25. Right, so if you don't get the term weights right, the whole thing's a mess, and the system can't learn very much. But if you do get the term weights right, then there is a signal, and then the question is, how far out here do you go? Okay? Now, of course, the way to know how far out here to go is to do an evaluation. If you do this evaluation, it's a waste because you must have already known what was relevant, otherwise you couldn't do the evaluation. Why did you need to build the system? So you actually want the system to run on future things. And so you'd like to have some way of knowing roughly how to pick this. It turns out that if you take the values in the singular values, the ones that start large and get small, and we chop some off and threw them away, that you can plot them on a log-log plot. So this is the rank of the singular value. And this is the singular value, the numbers off that diagonal. And on a log-log plot, they plot like this. And experience from signal processing says that when it diverges from a straight line on a log-log plot, that's a pretty good indication that you're down in noise. That's the difference between signal and noise. Right? And what this says is the signal behaves like a long-tail distribution, and then it diverges from that when you get to noise. Noise just starts behaving randomly. Okay? So that's not a bad cutoff. Okay, so for those of you that are really getting into this, this is actually all in my dissertation, and you can go read it. I've got that picture set up there quite that much. All right. Great fun. I want to leave you with a thing to think about over the break. This won't work. For reason. That's not because all this is a bad idea. It's because this rank order, if I keep showing you the same documents, then the things that you put at the top before will get put at the top in the future. So this rank order, the mean average precision on this will keep getting better. It will start saying completely unreasonable things. I mean, look. If I told you these 10 documents are relevant, which documents should you list first to get a high score? These 10, right? if you updated your query,
your profile,
so that these, so it moves closer to these documents, which documents will be ranked first? The ones you already knew were relevant, right? And I'll give you credit for telling me that they're relevant. So the mean average precision measure, or any measure you can come up with, precision to 10, whatever you measure, in these relevance feedback settings, can't be used to tune the system. Because what I do is I converge on the set of things I'm telling you are relevant and put them up at the top, and then when you look at the top 10, do the things you told me were relevant in the past.
Wouldn't you just look at new documents?
So if you looked at new documents, then your performance would get worse over time because you'd eventually run out of, imagine, a fixed collection.
Oh.
You'd eventually find everything that had been found. So your final performance would be zero, right? Under your well-tuned system, and the really well-tuned system would get to zero faster. Yeah?
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought that model had a flow of documents coming in.
Yes. So if you have a flow of new documents coming in, that's one way to get out of this.
Okay.
Right? And there are two other ways to get out of this, which I'll tell you after the break. Okay, so if you want to come up during the break and plug in a machine and see if it works, that's fine. Or if you don't, you can just hope for the best, and when your time comes, come in and come up and plug in a machine. Which is a problem. Load your PowerPoint onto this machine here.
So we can
you should be able to log into the machine using your own account. So you should be able to have two logins back.
Actually,
if
this
can
not be there.
It's leading to the guys. That's the problem is I can't get it to the interface. But
I saw that you said
I get the
and that you have to go to your well, I'll grade them both at the same time. It's actually good that I didn't get to grade your previous one. It wasn't my original question.
And then I
did them a little bit.
Do something zero out of zero hits because it doesn't. This error comes when I tell it apart of your data, when I don't tell it their index, then it's zero hits. When I tell it apart, then it's reasonable.
So absolutely the comparison would be more valid if you have the same system with and without. I haven't yet looked at what you said, but that question, the answer is clear, yes. Okay. Can we meet tomorrow and I can have this read before then? Is that convenient for you? Are you both on campus then?
Yeah, I'm
okay, so I can meet you tomorrow at 5:00. Tomorrow, and I'll read both of your.
Okay. Okay.
sure. Let's step outside.
Unless we need a point of this.
I've actually never seen people do that.
So, we have a On the board, or draw a few more graphs, or even nodded when I was talking about this.
Stall technique.
What's that?
Stall technique.
I suppose. But would you like more discussion at that level? Is it the case that some of you would like more of it, and others of you would like less of it?
Probably.
Okay. Okay, so we'll keep moving in and out of this, right? We'll give that a try and see how it goes.
Okay, if it gets too far in one direction, say so. But we can do that for a long time.
Okay. How long is your dissertation?
What's that?
Dissertation.
350 pages. Oh, this is, I mean, this was the setup for the dissertation. Actually, I will show you next week the dissertation experiment. I'll send you that. So now, why don't we just... Okay, so I told you that there were a few little problems we had to worry about. And one of them I told you about is evaluation. So here's a technique for evaluation. It's called residual evaluation. It's exactly what you suggested. We'll simply focus on the new documents. And then, so if we have a fixed size collection, the new documents will be the ones we didn't show you before, and then that you didn't grade before. And then the ones that you didn't grade before for the second time, then the ones you didn't grade the first time, the second time, and the third time. And we'll only compare how well you did at a particular iteration. So I won't know how well you did. I can't say that you're doing better at three than you did at two. That comparison doesn't make any sense because the number of documents remaining to be found keeps going down. And if you do really well, it goes down really fast. So those that comparison across iterations wouldn't make sense. But comparison within an iteration, I can compare several different systems and say which one's doing better at the second iteration. Right? But only if I give them all the same feedback. Otherwise, the systems are doing different things. So I have a set of canned feedback, and here's how the evaluation works. Along comes a message, and you say, I think it's relevant. And I say, no answer. Okay. I think this one's relevant, and I say, you're right. So the only ones I give you feedback on are the ones that you ask me for feedback on, and for them, I only give you some of them. Then everybody has the opportunity to ask about any document, so now I've got a fair evaluation. Does that make sense? No. Not so a single person here. Okay.
Why would you not always ask about every document?
Because I make you pay a price every time you ask. Right? And then if you find a relevant document, it can help your filter get better. So every time you ask, if it's a non-relevant document, you lose points. If it's a relevant document, you gain points. And if it's an I don't know, it doesn't hurt you. So you want to ask about as many relevant documents as you can and as few non-relevant documents as you can. That make sense? Okay. So that's the setup of the TREC adaptive filtering TREC. I have a set of canned relevance judgments from a previous evaluation. I stick them in a vault, and you can pull out a relevance judgment if you pay the price, if you say I'm willing to take the risk. Right? And then if you win and find a relevant document, then you get a plus up in your score. If you pulled out a non-relevant document, it hurts your score, and in addition to hurting your score, you now have learned something from either one. But you might have also pulled out a document that I didn't have a judgment on, in which case, you get a pass. Okay? Then people did studies to find out whether we should aggressively show you lots of documents, we get to learn a lot, or whether we should be conservative and only show you a few documents, in which case we don't take much risk. Any guesses what the best strategy is? What's that?
You don't know.
That turns out not to be the best strategy. Any other guesses? That also turns out not to be the best strategy.
It depends.
On what?
The collection. The variability of terms and the...
So think about this, right? You're born not knowing anything, you, the poor filtering system, right? You don't know anything. Somebody comes along and they tell you what they're looking for, and you, fresh and cold as you are, believe them and try to give them things that they're looking for. But it turns out they're not looking for exactly what they asked for, right? Because they have this visceral thing going on, right? Remember all the visceral information-y stuff? So you have to learn what it is they want. So you want to actually show them a bunch of different things and see how they feel about this. Right? And then you show them a whole lot of different things. They'll pick the ones they like. Now you know what you want to do. Now you can be conservative. So initially you want to be fairly liberal. Show them lots of things, preferably lots of different things. Things that aren't too similar to each other. And then if they say they like something, show them more of those. Make sense? Okay, so you have a learning rate that you control, how aggressive you are. And that's almost always the right thing to do. When you have any learning system, you have it learn aggressively at the beginning until it gets in the right neighborhood, and then turn down the gain on the learning. Just like going from kindergarten to graduate school, right? I mean, you're wide open in kindergarten. By the time you get to graduate school, you're actually going, well, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. So you're actually believing a little bit about what you think to be the case and not flopping around changing, you know, oh, Democrat? Nah. Republican's fine. Republican? Nah. Democrat's fine. All right? You can do that when you're young, but after a while, you figure out what it is you are and you do it. That's what the filter test does. See, and I run experiments, and that turns out to be the case. People that try the very conservative?
Yeah.
People that try the very liberal?
No.
You got to be very wide open in the beginning. And then neck it down. Okay. So, you remember what I told you over here? That if I use the raw TF, the raw term frequency, this Lynn's Magnetic Indexing technique, which is what happens when you do single value decompositions, doesn't work very well. But if you use DM25, it works really well. Right? Remember that? Okay. So tell me what's in DM25. What are the three factors in DM25? You know, copy turbulence. Any turbulence.
Term frequency,
that would be one of them, that.
Inverse document frequency,
that's the second one.
Document length.
Okay, good. Now, remember from the homework, what happens when a term doesn't appear, what happens when a term appears in every document? It gets no credit at all, right? That was the consequences of the math, the way the logarithm was. What if it occurs in all but one document? Very little score, right? What if it occurs in only one document? Big score. What if it has never occurred before in the history of mankind? Zero documents. What do you mean no score? So here's what's been happening to my score. They've been going from zero. As I get fewer and fewer documents, they're getting larger and larger. It goes to zero now? That doesn't make any sense. Yes, it goes to infinity. If you actually do the computation, you get an infinite weight for a term that doesn't appear because, I mean, gosh, what you're really measuring is how informative is it to see this term? And here's a term that can't possibly occur. And it just did. I mean, just think how much you learned. Right? Okay, so when I want to estimate IDF, you're looking at me like, this can't possibly be true. When I want to estimate IDF on a stream, think about this. Do you believe that there are terms being used in the newspaper today that have never appeared in that newspaper before? Maybe not today, but I mean, there was some day when Kosovo was written for the first time in that newspaper, right? There's some day when, you know, Sarkozy got written for the first time. These terms all have infinite IDF. So we have to rebuild the IDF as we go, right? When we see a term for the first time, we'll say, ooh, I've seen that term once before somewhere. I don't remember where, but give it one, right? Just so it's not infinite. So it's a really nice term, but it's not so nice as to be infinite. So if I don't do this, you build the system, and it won't even run to completion because it tries to represent infinity inside the computer. Okay, so you got to think about that. So, I've got to worry about that. I also have to worry about how to batch up these updates, because if I update my IDF after every document, I'm sitting here doing a lot of work trying to keep my IDFs up to date. And I probably don't get much better than if I updated my IDF once a day or once a month. Right? So you want to batch the IDF update. And when you start, you've never seen any terms. Right? So you've got a root problem, because now you don't have any IDF. So what you do is you go buy a bunch of back newspaper issues and figure, okay, well, that's something like what we're doing. And so people who build IR systems keep a bunch of back newspaper issue collections in their back pocket all the time. And I don't know, somebody, one of the teams pulled out one of those, right, and said, here, can we do our research on that, right? So it's always handy to have a newspaper collection. But even if you were going to simulate arrivals of those, you could get a different newspaper collection to learn. Wouldn't be as good as the one you're working on. Okay, and we talked about the other issues. This has some danger of being like the last one. The matrices. Let me try and experiment with you. I'm thinking of a sequence of numbers, and I want you to pick the next number in the sequence. Okay?
There it is.
One, two, three, five. So how do you pick, hold on, how do you pick five?
Primes.
Okay? Who went for four? How would you pick four? Okay, which one of these is a better guess?
The question.
Knowing you, prime numbers.
17.
So, often in science, we don't actually know what causes things, but we take the assumption that the simplest explanation is the best. Occam's razor, it's called in science, right? Can we use something like that to tell us which one of these is better? And what would that be?
Probably sequential.
Why?
Because that is how it's the simplest answer, and it happens more frequently, I would assume, than prime numbers.
Well, I'm not sure that it's the simplest answer. I don't know what it means for something to be simpler. But I do know what it means for it to happen more frequently than prime numbers. So I'm willing to go with you on that one.
Well, if it's sequential, the order is just n plus 1. If it's prime, there's a more complex computation trying to find the next prime number. Am I buying that?
I'm not sure how I could cast that in a metric of simplicity that would apply to the other things I'd like to try. Sure. Right? I mean, because I have other ones that I could use that are, you know, like 1, 1, two,
two,
three,
no,
three,
no,
it's
seven, it's my birthday, right? But this, I mean, seemed really simple to me, it just wasn't to apparent to you, but it was a reasonable guess. You could have guessed my birthday, it would have been just as good as guessing 1122. So, the point is, if I show you a set of data, and I ask you to build a model for that data, there's no basis for believing one model is better than another, except your bias. You might be biased in favor of popularly used sequences. You might be biased in favor of repetition patterns. Something's got a little rhythm to it. 1, 1, 2, 2. Right? You might be biased in favor of the birthdays of your children. If I show you a sequence, all predictions for the next thing are equally valid in that there's no basis for any of them except your bias.
What if the sequence is larger than two numbers?
Okay. Uh, I'm not even sure I want to actually run the experiment. Let's say that I write down a set of sequence, a set of numbers, which are the numbers on the side of the metro cars that go by me, right? And then I just start reading you the numbers in the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
You can come up with some basis for predicting what the next number is going to be. I mean, I give you a very long sequence, and you're going to go, you know, like, I don't know, let's see, they seem to have this kind of a writ. I mean, you know, these are the people that find the words in the Bible written backwards, and right? I mean, there's always a sequence there. See, there's some kind of a pattern I can put on it that just occurs randomly.
Okay.
And look, there are lots of them. There's not just one.
If you get a long sequence, you can detect non-random sequences. I mean, there's patterns, there's prime numbers, there's things that start popping out without straining too hard.
So my point is you have some bias.
I have bias.
So you're every...
God does not say that.
What's that?
God does not say that.
Every prediction you can make is based on you having some form of bias. There's no way of saying what's right from a sequence of past data to predict the future. Yes? But there... Okay. So what we're going to have to do if we're going to build a machine learning system is we're going to have to build a bias into it, and then we're going to have to ask the question, is it useful for a purpose? It's different from the question you were asking. Is it consistent with my model of randomness? So I have some mathematical model that was random. Is this different from random in some meaningful way? And the trains going by probably are different from random in some meaningful way. There's a fixed number of trains, so this is going to be a repeating sequence at some level. So I'm going to have some way of doing this. I'll give you just one. Well, I'll give you, here's a set of seven. We've already talked about one, rodeo, hill climbing. So this says, if I'm in a neighborhood, look for the direction that leads to improvement and go in that direction. So if my query had been over here, I would have done better on these documents I just saw coming in. So that's a bias that says climb the hill. K&N is a kind of instance-based learning. I have lots of instances, and I find the instances most similar to mine, and I say my bias is that birds of a feather flock together. So I'm guessing that in this space, if I've designed the space well, that things that should have a similar label will use language in a similar way, and hence will have been in the same similar place in that context. So because we've got a team that's trying to build rules for finding documents, I thought I'd give you the rule induction example. So, it's actually a slide I wrote 10 years ago for your team. So, let's say I wanted to find a Boolean query that was that would retrieve this document and that I would like to have documents that are similar to this document, also retrieved. So what I would do is I would create the perfect query, and that would give me a very specific query, right? I have the documents, I take the AND of every term in the document, the AND NOT of every term that's not in the document, I do the OR of that across all the documents, right? Now the only problem with this query from my standpoint is it's a little too long. So now what I do is I go removing the components from this that make that have the least effect on my retrieved set. Right? And I do that until the size of my retrieved set starts to grow. So now I'm biased in favor of small of short queries and small retrieve sets. Right? Now, I didn't have to do that, but my bias in favor of short queries, but not letting the set size grow, will allow me to find the sweet spot. Okay, so what you guys were doing is called rule induction.
little bit of spam filtering here. The spam filtering article that we read came out just earlier in this year, and it came from Trek. And so I had lunch with the fellow who wrote the article, Gordon Tomek, last Friday, actually last Thursday, to talk about using his evaluation technique for a different problem. So I'll tell you about the evaluation technique that he's using. And here's what I want to do. I want to remove spam from my email. Okay? The problem is, I don't want to give you my email so you can do research on it. So I want you to build a spam filter, and instead of me sending you the collection, you send me the filter. I mean, if it's a spam filter, it ought to be able to filter spam, right, on my email. So I should be able to install it and run it on my email. Yes?
Okay.
Okay. So, now the problem is you'd never be able to train your system because you haven't seen my collection, and I'm not going to run it too much for you, otherwise you'd have it simply send you my email one bit at a time, right? So I'm only going to let you run it a limited amount of time. So I'm going to take another email collection, a public email collection, the one from Enron, which has no spam in it, not much spam in it, and I'm going to go get a bunch of spam from a spam trap, which is just an account set up that publicizes its email address on a web page, and the spammer scrapes the email address off the web page, starts sending it mail, but it's an account that never gets any other mail. So the only thing it ever gets is spam, right? So this allows us to start characterizing spam. So we take the spam coming into the spam trap, and we add it to the Enron email, which is a bunch of people talking to each other like normal, and now you have a fake collection that does not represent how the real spam would be matched quite perfectly. If your date mismatches, spam trap emails from now with the Enron emails from 5 years ago. So people are talking about different things. But then we can test it in this private evaluation framework. So that was the technique that they came up with for evaluation. In their paper, one of the things that they talked about was how compression-based classifiers worked really well, and nobody quite understood why. Did anybody get what a compression-based classifier was? Did anybody read the paper?
No.
Okay. Was that a no?
No, I read the paper.
Yes. That's exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you remember what I told you before about how I could take the index and compress it? And I told you that what we were going to do was we're going to give short codes to things that occurred often and long codes to things that didn't occur very often. Okay. So here's what they do. They take a collection of ordinary email, not spam, and they build a compressor. Right? So they figure out what's happening a lot, what's not happening very often, and they compress it so that it can be decompressed, distorted in a small amount of space, the ordinary email, and then read when it's decompressed. Okay?
And this is at the character level, not the term level, right?
That's right.
When you're compressing. Okay. Yeah.
So they're doing character sequences, actually. So they were compressing individual characters, but here you do character sequences. Right? So sequences of four characters, for example. Okay. Then what we do is we get a bunch of spam from a spam trap. And we build a compressor for it. So here's a compressor that compresses spam really well. It's very compact. Okay? And I got another compressor that compresses ordinary email really well, right? So now along comes a message. I simply compress it with both compressors. Whichever one compresses better, that's what it is. Yes? I mean, it's a delightfully clever way of taking something
that you invented for a different reason that you already know how to do and use it, right? If the frequency distribution of the four grams, character four grams, is more similar to the frequency distribution of the spam, it'll compress better with the spam compressor. That outperforms every other technique people have tried, and that's what's in your spam filters right now. It's sitting here compressing it. Whichever one compresses better, it does the appropriate thing and throws away the compressed version because it didn't really want it in the first place.
So why do you need to actually go through the process of compressing?
Oh, you're just computing the statistics. The compressed version pulled out as a byproduct. Yeah, you just never store it. Right? You just go through and you see how tightly you can go. It's the length of the compressed version is the only number you need. Yeah.
What about emails, which I know from my friend, but they go in bulk and they are spam? That happens a lot of times, especially nowadays in Yahoo. So what about those? Why do they go, like, for example, in bulk and don't come to my inbox?
I see. So you have an email from your friend. You know it's not spam.
Yes.
But your friend is actually a spammer on the weekends, and he writes a lot like a spammer.
You know?
Well, it's compressed pretty darn well. So every classifier will make one of two kinds of mistakes. It will either take something it should have rejected and give it to you, or it will take something that it should have given to you and rejected. And you can adjust this threshold, right? This is the recall precision trade. And so even the compression-based system will make mistakes. It just makes fewer mistakes.
Even though if I have received that email before in my inbox.
So, what really happens in real spam filters is that people can create blacklists and whitelists. So the most standard way of creating a whitelist, people who are trusted, are people to whom you have sent emails. They should be trusted. If Yahoo doesn't automatically whitelist those people, maybe you should switch to Google or to somebody that does. If I'm getting email from somebody who's bothering me, I can pop them on a blacklist. Now here's what really bugs the email companies. I signed up for a mailing list that will send me updates every day of, you know, I don't know, the traces of the latest Apollo memorabilia. Yeah. 3 weeks later, I lose interest in that. But it still sends it to me every day, and I've forgotten how to unsubscribe. Right? So what do I do?
You report it to spam.
I report it to spam. Right? At which point, they retrain all their filters so that nobody gets Apollo memorabilia, because now it compresses really well. It's got those Apollo words and stuff like that. So the spam filter folks get very noisy training coming back. And so did you notice that? I mean, the article is written by people at Microsoft. It had this Microsoft sort of flavor to it, right? All the examples were Microsoft. But Microsoft has something very valuable if you want to build spam filters. They have Hotmail. Right? And what they did was they hired a bunch of Hotmail users, which they described as, did I get this right, 10,000 Hotmail users who every day mark a batch of spam and send it back to them? So those people are trained and trusted more than the average people. Right, so you can screw up your filter, but you won't screw up the whole filter that's going on high. On the other hand, 300 of those people are spammers. I mean, there are 10,000 of them, so you know, there are a few spammers snuck in and got trusted. And so did you see how they also describe how those spammers are sending messages? They get a Hotmail account. And then they go send themselves a bunch of messages until one of them gets through, and they go, hey, that's a really good way to send everybody on Hotmail. And then they send that message really quick to everybody on Hotmail. And so what the people at Hotmail are doing is they're looking for people sending themselves email a lot. And they're saying, hey, that's what spammers do. And they shut down the account before the spammer can do that. So if you want to see how well this works, get a Hotmail account and send yourself a lot of very similar emails in a very short period of time and see how long you have a Hotmail account. Right? So the spammers are taking advantage of the fact that they can see Hotmail, and Hotmail is taking advantage of the fact that they've got these trusted people that they can pick. Everybody is trying to organize not just the technical infrastructure here. This is very much a social process as well. Okay, so there are all sorts of really good stuff in there. There's a bunch of fairly obscure stuff about how they're using authentication. I mean, I thought actually in the paper they kind of talked around this subject of how they're using authentication to make it more expensive for scammers to do what they do, right? Because what you can do right now, you can't really impugn a scammer's reputation because the scammer could be pretending to be me. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that the University of Maryland has a high reputation. So the University of Maryland tries to prevent spammers from using its machines, right? And then we want to make sure that we can authenticate things and say, yes, that really came from Maryland. And then we could use some of that reputation. The problem is that if I really want to spam you, what I want to do is I don't want to spam you from my machine. That would make me very easy to shut down. I want to spam you from his machine. So what I'll do is I'll just give you some free software, which you can download. And the free software will do exactly what I promised. And every night between 3 and 5 in the morning, if you don't use your computer between 3 and 5 in the morning, it will become a spam redirector. So anything I want sent, I'll just send it to your machine, which is a nice trusted machine and a trusted domain here at the University of Maryland. And so I actually have friends that told me when they first put this thing in that they stopped getting email from me because the University of Maryland was a known spammer. And it was because of these zombie machines. And so there are people who go out and take over machines, and then they sell the access to those machines to other people. There's a whole market going on among these people.
Last week, a guy confessed.
What's that?
A guy confessed to that from somewhere in Atlanta that he was
doing this. And it's a little hard to use the legal system to stop people from doing this, because they could be anywhere on the planet.
Yeah.
Do we use
the
freeware software?
Is
that
what's
possible?
Like
Lucene? So open source is supposed to guard against this, because let's say that I'm a spammer and I'm a zombie maker that will take over your machine and sell it to a spammer. Well then I want your machine to behave in a way that you don't want it to behave, but I don't want you to know it's doing it. So the last thing I want to do is send you the source code. Because if you're a programmer, you can just look at it and see what it's doing. Right? And we set up firewalls on the machine, so you know, these days, XP comes with the firewall turned on, so that if your machine starts trying to go do something weird, you have to answer the question, do you want to let it do it? But of course, my mother always pushes the yes button. I think my mother's actually one of these zombies. That's all right. Do you have a question? Okay. So it's great fun, but I think we pretty much got through this. That article is the kind of thing that I want you to think about for the final exam. Now I say that because you all gave me these blank stares on having read the article. But it attaches to the kinds of problems that you have in the real world and to the kind of techniques that we've been talking about. So the final exam will have a structure where we'll pick a problem like that, and we'll ask you how you would approach such a problem, what issues would arise. In the filtering issue, if I never told you about filtering before, it'd be really cool if you could come along and say, well, wait a minute, the IDS would be infinite. You know, if you had some TF-IDS thing, don't just tell me you can use TF-IDS, tell me you can use TF-IDS, and the IDS would be infinite. So I'd structure up questions like what kind of approach would you take, what kinds of problems do you expect you'd have to, you know, that approach would raise. And we could do the same thing with spam filtering. We could do it with preventing web index spam. All right, so the adversarial IR problem is very rich. Do a blog comment spam. Okay. So, now for something completely different. Your turn. Who's up first? Are you guys on both machines?
Yeah.
Yes?
Mm-hmm. We're really for our user study focusing on graduate students who may be, or future graduate students who may be using the system to find professors or advisors who match their personal research interests, mostly because we can find grad students and study them. And we've decided that indexing and searching the entire campus isn't really within what we can do and the amount of time given, so we decided to work with List and Anthropology. List because we know it, and Anthropology because we don't. And it's sizable enough that we can take it on, and we have a few connections, and we can, again, study the grad students. We decided that to create our index, we focus on CDs when we could get them, pages that they have up on the internet about themselves, and the most recent papers we can get a hold of. Oh, and Aaron wanted me to mention that we had a long discussion about their bibliography pages and what sort of information should we maybe try to throw out to do some filtering on the way in. A paper might have the place of publication of the company that published the paper, and is that going to throw out an irrelevant result if somebody publishes in a journal that was published in Germany and someone's doing a foreign language, looking for a foreign language professor, and they find a list professor because they published in a German publication, would that be bad? And we decided that we trust our users enough to use more than one word to search, and we trust our ability, hopefully, to rank enough that maybe that information could at times be useful if somebody spoke at a conference in Germany and were trying to think, I remember I saw something at that conference in Germany, but we threw it out, that would be bad. So we're going to leave it all in. We probed students for information needs. We sent them emails and said, when you were looking at programs and you needed professors who matched your research interests, what was your information need? And they sent us a short paragraph back. We then went and visited one of the professors in his office hours. This is the idea that was being discussed before class, and said, we have these sets of information needs. Who in your department matches that? So now when we test, we have a list of relevant results to compare it to. And our output page gives each person's name, a link to their web page, and a little blurb about their research interest. And we're going to try to measure our precision at five. For our user evaluation, we came up with a couple of questions we want to answer. Can novice users really get into the system quickly and learn it? And because our results page is a list of people and not a list of the documents that the index was, that the system was searching to find those people, do the users have confidence that those results are really relevant? Because if the system found a result from a CD, but what I'm showing you is the person and their contact information, there's no context there for why I showed you that. Are you really confident that I showed you something good? And we're going to observe people using the system, hopefully have them fill out a survey one at a time so that before they have a chance to talk to each other about the system, and then have them all discuss the system together in a group.
And in, when we ask users about that, we'll also ask them, like, do they prefer this system, like, which shows the name, the web page, and the research area? Or do they prefer a system like Google, for example, which shows keyword in context? So we get the difference between them. Obviously, in our case, it's not possible to show the keyword in context. So what are the time limits?
We have built two systems,
which
are not really
many. So we'll just take that feedback.
Okay, so now we're going to show you a little bit of what we've put together so far.
Okay, so this is what we got from the graduate assistant who's working right now on this system. And we tweaked it a little bit. So tweaking it a little bit, we had to tell you a lot. So now, when we got the system, we had four Qlis processes in the database. And we had indexed four documents of four different professors from the Qlis. And then we added 11 professors from anthropology and a couple of other Qlis professors, and we are in the process of adding more, indexing more. So, for example, and the system is designed for Boolean queries. So, for example, if you search for information, it almost gives everything that's there, Department of Anthropology and Qlis. And if we search for, even gives a couple of names. Now I had a chat with we were not sure whether it's doing rank retrieval or not. So I had a chat with the DA about this, and because I was like, Dr. Owen's name should come above Dr. Sorkin. But he was like, for that to happen, the paper published by Dr. Owen had to mention the words information and retrieval, right? More often than mentioned by Dr. Sorkin. So it's based on that. We are indexing the documents. We are not indexing your mind or your research interest. And this is not, this is not the things we have indexed. This is just we have stored in the database. So we went to the faculty's webpage, and whatever they have a column called research areas, so we just take that and put it in the database. And if there's a match, we output give this free information to the faculty with their webpage. We click on this. And the department and research area. And right now, actually, I checked manually, so it's not, I don't think it's giving rank retrieval. I hope we find a way to change it so that it does give, because the agent told me that Lucene has an inbuilt sort function which should give rank retrieval. And I could check that manually. I did that, but I don't think it's giving rank retrieval. I did that for a couple of queries. I don't think it's rank ordered. I'm not sure how to change that thing, and where is it? Is it in explicit code or where?
So the most likely place to find this is in a query parser. The query sets up a certain kind of query, so a Boolean query would not give rank results. It would give a set. Like you could create a ranked query.
We should do that in the query parser?
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to work on that.
Now, I have a question for you, and you all should be thinking up difficult questions, too. Can you go back to your slides?
Okay. Actually, no.
Okay, and no.
Are they on your screen?
Oh, well, don't worry about it. So, you said, don't worry about it. You said that you're going to do precision at 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you
think? I thought we were in our paper 30. I don't know. It's up for debate. We're still...
You're going to do precision at 30?
No, possibly 3. I mean, if
three,
I'm
okay.
Searching information retrieval, I only get 2 results.
Right, it seems a little
fuzzy. Searching at 5 seems a little big. So we're thinking, we're still debating our actual precision.
So one measure that you might want to think about for a set like this is the rank at the first relevant, in this case, relevant professor. Right? So let's say that you get a useless professor first and then a good one. Then it would be rank 2, right? So then the average across several topics of that, that's called the expected search length. Now people will most often do this using the inverse, it's the inverse of the average of the inverse, which is the geometric. So you could take the harmonic mean of these rather than the arithmetic mean. But the general idea is expected search length. You could certainly report both measures, but one's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One interesting thing we've found in the challenges of building a system globally for the campus is the diversity of ways that different departments decide to present information about their professors. And what we found was that anthropology was much more uniform than CLIT. And my assumption, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that CLIT professors are given a lot of freedom to set up their own web page because they're information professionals and they can set up a web page. And then the anthropology department says, well, maybe our professors don't know so much about setting up web pages, so we'll just give them a template and say, stick it in. Where
I think that's a charitable interpretation.
Is it?
I mean, my interpretation would be that anthropology is doing better with this than CLIT.
Well, yes, but I'm saying that the
you're saying you're imagining we had a principled motivation.
Yes.
No, I think anthropology had a principled motivation.
Okay. So they have these really nice biographies, and then the CVs are stored in two different versions, and they all have this searchable copy that's from Macromedia Flash Player that I've never actually heard of before, that I found that fascinating. So I'll share. I'm done sharing.
Okay, questions?
So you said you have this database that has faculty and their expertise. So how do you establish the association between them? Is it something you store manually? Or?
So yeah, basically when we take a document, for example a professor's CV, okay. We keep it in the folder where you see the index.
Okay.
Then what we do is we take that information of the professor, these four details, the name, the web page, the department and the research area. We store it in a database file or SQL. And then the database actually, like when it sees there is a match for this document, so there is a file, XML file. So it takes the name of that professor and it does a query which matches with the name, and then it picks that record from the database. It's an RDBMS. So when we have the result for displaying it, all this part is done. So when we see that, okay, Dr. Oates is matching, so then we go in that XML file, because we see the document which is matching, right? We take the title of that, so the title name is Dr. Oates. We take that, we go in the database, do a name match, and it's
ready. Right. So we have a single XML file that holds all
the documents. The person who has written the document, the year, and other.
Another question?
Research area is that fully
crawled
with the document?
This is what we have stored in the database. We took this from the web page of the faculty.
I guess you manually enter research error snippets, or did it?
Yeah, we manually enter in the
database. So you have to do the whole campus that would be scaled?
Well, our campus is good scale, I guess. Because we just need to store. There's a single column, like this, for Dr. Oates, there's just this thing. He's mentioned research area colon, and he's mentioned this. He just picked this and put it in the database. For 100 professors, 200 professors.
But there are 2,000. So did I just check correctly, you're not searching those things?
Searching about this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because part of what we index is the web pages, and that information
is on
the web pages.
Oh.
I assume their other professors don't have any web pages at all.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you go to the CLIT faculty list, I know a lot of them are
many.
Plenty of adjuncts.
Yeah.
That's what like one of the problems we face. Like if you don't have your information, then if you want someone to find you, you will put your information. Now we found this problem like.
But people might want to find people that don't necessarily know they want to be found.
And what they use the finding that person. Because if you are a PhD student and you are looking for a particular faculty member, now we faced this problem because we saw a couple of CVs which were like 1995 and the professor is teaching right now. So we asked them to update their CV. So it was like, if you are doing any other research work, then how is the student supposed to find you if you are not listed back anywhere?
Well, they've got tenure. They don't need to update anything.
Well, that's a good point. When I went and spoke to the faculty member in anthropology and explained to him the system and what we were trying to do, he said, well, you know, some professors just don't even bother. He says, I think the university has something like that, that they ask us to go in and update, but a lot of people don't bother to update it. I said, well, that's kind of the point, is we're trying to find a way to automate it a little bit. And he's like, well, people just don't want to be bothered, because it's just a media calling, and we have to try to do that. So there's definitely a I don't want to be found element.
Very
well.
So I thought you get aggressiveness points for just showing up at office hours.
Oh, I emailed him and I asked if I could come to his office hours. And he said, yes.
So I thought you were just showing up at office hours like, by the way, would you please do these roll acceptance forms? It's your office hours, you need the students, don't you?
For knowing anthropology students come in handy, it's like, oh, so and so, who is your advisee? Told me that maybe I could come see you.
Okay, thank you very much. When the next group is setting up, why don't we take a quick stretch break?
So the team that makes the MIR is from Daniel. The team that makes the injury is from UMass. And they brought together to develop the reach. So UMass created a big brand for us because UMass has a good brand. And they focus on So the MIR was built first, that's why the version 4.5 heavyweight. And then injury was second, and then they were integrated into the release that has injury version and the label version that you're getting the same focus.
There's all kinds of weird things going on. You couldn't change the law. They had to.
Be sure this or this?
But if they wouldn't modify, they had to turn down. There's no reason not to appeal. They're trying not to do it. Well, they're going to set up.
Sure.
15.
Good.
Is it one of them also?
I've got one rep, right?
Non-voting rep.
Yeah.
Or some of our homes here.
Yeah.
That's her name.
She's the only person to hold her on.
Yeah, everyone loves her.
We are also doing our project on an expert search for the University of Maryland. We're also doing it in the College of Information Studies, but we're doing it with the College of Information Studies and also the Clark School of Engineering. And the reason for that is because of lack of time and resources. Doing the whole university would take much more time than we have.
So you picked the 300 faculty member engineering school instead.
We like to aim high. So Flux will give us a lot more documents to go from. And so what we were going to do with our search engine was we were going to collect a bunch of documents using the web port, or
research port.
We've gotten some documents from other faculty members that we can use. We're going to add this to a database, and using XML, we're going to link all these documents to different faculty members. We're going to try and have as many faculty members as we can in the Clark School of Engineering and the College of Information Studies. And what this would do is, when a person enters in a keyword or subject that they're looking for someone who has expertise in, it would come through this database and it would come up with several professors' names. We don't want too many because a student's not going to be looking for 20 professors that they can go to for information, probably somewhere between 2 and 5 or something like that, something manageable. But the three different things we're going to be using to determine whether the professor's an expert are their documents, papers they've published, any or papers that they've participated in, courses that they teach using the course catalog, and also looking at their bio, like whether they have a degree in a certain field, whether they've taught classes in the past. Their bio might say they have expertise actually in something. So we haven't certainly decided yet how we're going to weight those different things, because obviously we're going to have a lot more documents, hopefully, than we will information. Like, there's going to be one bio, there's going to be maybe a number of courses the professors taught before, but it's going to be hard. The difficulty is going to be determining how much weight to give to each one of those. And we also have to go through, and at some point we have to run a test to see how relevant, how effective our search is in determining the relevance for the documents. So it's going to search through and see if it finds the keywords in the documents, and just like Boolean search, the more occurrences of that keyword in the documents, the higher the rank, and that'll put it higher up. And we were planning to just do the top 50 documents. That might change. But that's still a work in progress. But anyway, it's going to take those documents, link it through the XML to the professor, and then ideally it's going to give professor names similar to the one that the last group was showing. And we're going to have a demonstration in a little bit. And Patrick's going to talk about that.
you take a little bit of the XML because that's one of the differences between us and the other group. One of the problems we're trying to solve is it'd be nice if we could get rid of the whole relational database to link the professor bios with the documents that are returned by the query. So one of the suggestions we're trying to do is use one XML file for each professor, each faculty member, and in that XML file have the entire text of everything we find for them. So the entire text of all the papers we find for them, their website, the courses they teach, and that way the corpus, in fact, will entail one document, XML document, for every faculty. And that way, once you find it, you already had, if you have it in the XML, if you see a bug in here, you would already have all their information and be able to plug that right into the output. So that's one of the problems we're trying to solve with this, is trying to circumvent going through the relational database. We also were thinking that it would help us remove duplicates. I didn't see any duplicates on the example previously, but if you only have one document per faculty, then you're not going to get duplicates, and that removes that. So that was one of the reasons we wanted to go ahead and approach. Some quick screenshots. We have Lucene working, we just haven't got it all connected to pieces. So this is what we're kind of envisioning it to look like. It's kind of blurry, I apologize. Very similar to the Google interface, although we want to return the faculty's name, their email address, their contact information. That way you don't have to click through and go to a profile page. You want it to be right there in the results. Hopefully it'll add a little bit of value to the user experience. And I don't know what happened to all the other two screenshots, but it was similar to that. But we want to have an advanced search to filter by department and stuff like that. And Sandy will show you kind of where we are with the scene.
This is just the front end, which we altered from the basic routine. And we just enter the query. For now, it's only searching text files and HTML files, so it's not really giving any relevant results. But our main thing, what we are trying to do right now, is to make a JSP script or some sort of a parser which can get the results from those XMLs and just show those results instead of giving the name of the document and what is in the document. So we are in process of developing that part of the GSP, and we are working on that so that once we get a result from this search, instead of showing the research, we will show the contact information from the XML file which we have prepared. So this is the part what we have, and we haven't given any options for now, but the plan is to have an advanced page where you can say how many results you want and how many which college or which department you want to search, maybe to add results.
So can you say something about OTEL? That's the I'll stand over here. Hotel is a server that the university offers for projects, and it has all the server-side scripting and stuff you would need for this project. So with Dr. Orr's help last week, we kind of got one set up, and we're in the process of taking what Sandeep and Alana worked on in Sandeep's laptop and moving it over to the Hotel server. And once we have that set up, we'll have a centralized server with all of the program running on it, all the supporting technologies that support it, and we'll be able to kind of all use remote access to configure it and test it. And it's actually live and up on the web right now.
So let me see if I have this right. So there's one Unix account that all of you can log into, or that each of you has separate accounts?
It's our own directory.
Okay, and then you log on to this, and then you can go to a shared space?
It's basically, we are logging onto the Glue only. But in a Glue, they have created a special instance where you can navigate to, or you can go through the web interface, which you can show back.
And then any one of you can take a perfectly good working system and break it.
Correct.
I mean, consider my deal and end up breaking the view because we really don't know where the queries go or what view might be. Maybe we start indexing the whole server cluster. So we are just
don't index.
Like accidentally I indexed my whole drive. I don't want to do that on the glue.
So have you considered implementing CVS or some kind of version control so that you can roll back from punitive improvements?
Well, we're trying to develop a sound business process, as we say in my work, and just before making any changes, just back up the entire directory structure.
You could, but a version control system would make your life much simpler.
The Eclipse software that we use has inbuilt CVS, so we haven't explored that. We are not at a stage where we really need that, but we have.
Only when different people are working in the same code base. Yes. When you're doing synchronous and just, you know, passing jar files around, you're fine. Because always somebody has, you know, an outdated version that you can load back to. But when it's only in one place, the backups will protect you against system crashes, but they won't protect you against stupidity. Yes. And stupidity is much more common than system crashes.
Fair enough.
Okay, questions?
So you said you are using RDBMS, right?
Well, we have them right now, but
you plan to use them. So that is like that is the initial part or the final part? Because we are using that for when we get the results, then to display. That's where we are using that.
It's our understanding that we can get rid of the database totally using the XML files and parsing out the XML files and grabbing the information that's encoded in there and mapping that to the HTML output. So that's what we're really trying to do. We want to get rid of that step, but we have the database there as a backup. Should we not be able to figure that out? Alok, do you want to comment on that? Or?
As you said, we are looking at a possibility of totally dispensing with the database. So all the data that you store in the database will have in single XML files. The XML has various tags, like we saw the names and stuff, and all the text information is also in the XML file?
Yes.
That's right. That's what we found.
Parse the PDF or the web page and just paste it in a information tag under there.
So you manually take each PDF and parse it? Oh no, we don't enter the information from the PDF into the XML. It's just the information about the author that's there in the XML.
We'd have to put the full text of all the documents in the XML file to get rid of the database.
Yeah.
So that would be a manual process. It would be something that could be automated, you know, with some scripting or program tools, but that's kind of out of the scope of what we're trying to do. If we get proof of concept, we'll be happy.
So we'll give you two quick comments. We got in Trek, there was an expert search task that both groups might be interested in. And the expert search that was done for this year was done not at a university but at a government research lab in Australia that has 6,000 researchers. And they created XML records just like this. You can go to a website in Australia, type in your identifying information to register, and then download the collection. So already there's a test collection done, and there are relevance judgments available for you. So if you'd like to do 6,000 people instead of a few hundred people, you could take a look at that collection. It's from CSIRO, C-S-I-R-O, and I can send you the information on how to get it. But the Enterprise Track website, just Trek Enterprise Track, should have the information that we're interested in.
Okay.
The other thing is that there's been an active research area in information retrieval to try to figure out the best way to attack this problem. There are basically two approaches. One is your approach. We'll throw everything in one document and index it. The other is we'll find the best papers on this topic, and then we'll let the best papers vote for the best professors. And the second technique works better.
Well, can we rewind the clock to September and start over?
No. How to think, ways of thinking about the problem. You can certainly keep going the way you're going.
Okay, so once you get the best document, you go to the database to find who has written.
Who wrote the best document?
How do you get content?
You write them. I have the query.
So the papers are voting for the best professor, or?
Well, in the general case, you don't just take the top one. If the top one paper is voted for one professor, and the next 10 papers all vote for another professor, maybe the other professor is actually the better professor for the square. So a voting strategy of some sort.
Right.
And then there are papers on how they vote. What's that?
But it's like the old way, you went for an advisor based on if they published in your area.
Right.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay, now if you'd like to have a coup, the State Department team will be happy to help you prepare for your coup. So if you're going to plug in, you want to do it over here. We'll do three of these tonight, we'll do three of these tomorrow. Or three of these next week. Tomorrow program.
I'll be done by then.
Say that.
Of the data collection before we show you the demo. But it's a really neat collection. I'm surprised that the State Department, or actually the National Archives, had been able to publish as much of it as they have. It's not a complete collection from the State Department's perspective because some of the information is still classified. But what they've declassified from the early 1970s is a telling story about what was happening behind the scenes for what you see in some of the headlines. Since this is well before the internet revolution and email, this is business class email from the early 70s. It's in a telegram format. There's a couple peculiarities that we thought we could take advantage of to make a system that's better than what the National Archives has up on its website today. One of them is that telegrams are addressed to organizations, and the State Department has named their embassies by the city that they're in as opposed to the country that they're in. In some cases, State Department headquarters is sending a note out to a particular embassy while they're going to assume that the recipients know what country they're in. Today, a researcher is going to be looking for what's happening in a particular country and may not know that the name of the country doesn't exist in the message. Also, there's a tags field that is kind of a shorthand. It's early 70s, bandwidth is a big issue. Telegrams, you're paying by the character, especially if you're encrypting on one end and decrypting on the other and not trusting the comms in between. So to send a message about a particular topic, in DOD, the tag would include things more like somebody tried to cross the perimeter fence and get into our base, or please send more bullets, or we spent a few rounds last night. Each of those has a small 3 or 4 letter tag. The State Department's tags are a little bit different, and they're very different today than they were in the early 70s, but the National Archives was kind enough to put up the tags that existed at the time. Again, for knowing that the author of the message is using a tag, he may not reference the guts of his message, the plain language keywords that a searcher today would be looking for. Rather, he's just going to use that tag and assume that the recipient knows what he's talking about.
diplomats as politicians. The first time they talk about something, it's not going to be the same as the last time they talk about something. I'm going to say a bit more about that in the next. We talked earlier about having an information need that can be satisfied by the first document you find. Dr. Ward had mentioned if you're looking up Doug's phone number, finding it 100 times is no more relevant than finding it the first time. But in this data collection, for the users being historians, they want to see how a particular topic evolved over time. So they're not going to want to see just the first message or some part of the collection. They're going to want to see everything relevant to their query, even if it means a very large set to look through. Okay, for our system, I'm still having a Dickens of a time learning Lucene. And we did get through multiple term queries, but the index is all in caps, and as you use a multiple term query, as it parses the terms, it forces them into lowercase. We have a bit of a workaround now, but we're hoping the ultimate solution is either to find a way to force uppercase terms into the back end, or re-index it and move everything in the collection into lowercase. Similarity values, again, trying to map an embassy name to the country or the location that it's inside of, or map tags to what the tags mean. There's two approaches. One Lucene seems to have a bit more support for, and that is loading in all of those abstraction or all of those similarity values into the index. That's possibly a change to our original design of adding those terms to a query at the point the user has to query in its go. That's it for slides. We'll put the monitor over.
So while you're switching over, can I ask you about this thing you put up about researchers would want to know what's happening in the newspapers at the same time?
Started looking through how we would go about a user study. Best thing we could find of what a researcher in the early 70s would be interested in actually came from Wikipedia. They put up a year in review. And you go down the headlines from that year and say, oh, Watergate interests me. Let's see if Watergate, or click on the Wikipedia link and get relevant terms there. Let's see if those terms appear in any of the behind the scenes State Department cables at the time.
This is not our system. This is the Sonera system that we may have used during that special work assignment at the United semester. Ours is unfortunately not in your just yet. This is our user interface thus far. Really, really happy that it got this far. So not what we had this time last week. And unfortunately, the user interface is a step behind what Dave and Linda have been able to work on in terms of the back end. But this is what we've got going so far. So if you type in China and you search, you get a list of the telegrams that have been indexed that include China. So. Thank you.
books?
Yeah.
Okay, we successfully found that there's no bush in there anymore.
Still work in progress.
Instead of the hack for being able to get through the query turning terms in the lowercase was to add a symbol at the end to make it a wild card query where it's looking for things similar to bush. And then setting the wild card similarity threshold really high so it's looking for things very, very, very similar to bush in all caps.
I'm hoping there's some way to make it flip-flop between.
I can show you that. That one's not right. Okay, very good. So, questions?
Is that a ranked list?
If it kicks one out, it does make a ranked list.
On the user interface? The one which came up, China?
Yes. In the API, there's a explanation object that you can solicit out of a parse query. That'll give you the math behind how it makes term frequencies and IDFs, inverse document frequencies. We'd be able to pop that up. After seeing the math behind the scenes, it didn't seem very meaningful to show that to users rather than just show them, here's your list in a ranked sort of sense. At the point we would be giving this to a user and say, hey, extract out what you want to write your book about. He's most likely going to want to have it in chronological order rather than this was a very short message that included lots of your search terms lots of times. And that's what would cause it to be at the top of the rank list.
We did find a pretty neat tool called Loop that took your leucine index or whatever and actually sort of did some analysis on it and gave IDF scores for the different terms, which was cool.
Other comments, questions?
So just basically the contents of the telegrams are tags, like the name of the address and then the text of what's in the telegram. Is that what you're working on?
Picture a very early vintage email and then trying to press it down by getting rid of some common strings like the name of
the Do you have to index the tags and the text separately? Is that?
It'll go from address to addressees, a classification line, a subject line, a tag line, and then the message text. In the National Archives, they added 20 to 30 other fields of data that all have to do with who manually reviewed it in order to declassify it and put it up on their website.
The person that threw in jail, they got it wrong.
Correct.
And the index? Where did the indexing come from?
We indexed with Lucene.
Oh, okay.
With something that was just a few steps away from their basic Lucene giving index.
Okay, very good. Let's thank this group. And I made a couple of notes here as everybody was talking. I really like the work that people have done on thinking about the way in which things are going to be used. Hitting up the professors in anthropology, understanding what's different about things that are written in the 70s and how people might talk about them today. This will keep you from doing what is common in class projects, which is to do what you know how to do rather than to do what you need to do. Right? Of course, you'll have to find something in between those two, but it would be good if what you were learning how to do was what needs to be done. And so living in that world of ideas is important. The class has as one of its major goals to get you to think about the implementation of complex systems. Now, I don't feel too good yet. Maybe I'll feel better at the end of the semester. Maybe you'll feel better at the end of the semester about how we approach this, which is simply there's a pool over there, got water in it, we'll throw you in,
and well, you can probably learn to swim. It's worked remarkably well. I mean, you've got working systems that are starter kit systems that have that are complex. They do a lot of stuff. They put together all the things that we're doing in class. So for all of the limited support that, you know, meetings with me, meetings with TA June, talking through ideas, reading your design and commenting on it, has provided, Bill's done just a phenomenally good job of getting to a point where you can now do something that's really interesting. The third thing is that I really like the thinking that you've done about evaluation. The way in which I can get a feel for how you're thinking is to see how different the kinds of evaluations you're proposing are from each other. So there really is a lot of you and a lot of how you think about evaluation in these evaluations. Some of them have strong points and weak points that are different from the others, but in what I've read so far, you've been acknowledging where the strong points and weak points of the approach that you're taking are. And I think that's really good. So I'm just absolutely delighted with where the project's going. Now, you all probably realize that in a few weeks, this will not be the perfect system, right? Any one of the systems. It might actually turn out that some of you will make such interesting systems that you will go on and do something with them beyond the class. But that's not really the goal. The goal is whether it allowed you to learn things that you'll value knowing, that you didn't know before you tried to do this. So keep that in mind as you go along, that the goal is not to get, you know, a really good, complete system that people could use, but rather one that allows you to explore the parts of this that you're trying to do. So I thought this is just a masterful set of presentations tonight to bring together these ideas in ways that, you know, I looked at you guys the first day of class, and you were looking at me like I was from another planet. Actually, the second week of class, right? Yeah, you were just like, what did he say? And there was an awful lot of, would you please slow down a little bit at the end of that. But today, there was an awful lot of, can you go deeper into this? Can you take this idea and connect it over to that idea? Right? So you're really getting to where we want to get to in a class like this, in a graduate class, where you're taking responsibility for what you're learning and driving it in the direction that you personally want to go. Questions, comments? Do three more of these next week? Okay, we'll see you then. Oh, and if anybody wants to talk about issues that came out of, or that they came up in a talk about how to lowercase things or any of those things, I'm happy to set up time with you or answer by email.
One thing that we can probably
Having something that people can play with by Friday. Not feeling like that's fine.
We've got like 4 weeks before we have to turn the lead.
We don't have it.
So if you could play with the system longer before we put the system in front of them, I'm okay with that. And if we can't do a grad, I'll be here on Friday afternoon and say, we need to all the system right now. So we'll just start up and see what comes out. We just do need to do 5 days, like an email.
It has a open source version and a commercial version.
Thank you both for the
information.